You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
6 minutes after 10. Thank you so much for staying with us. And as promised, this hour, we're talking about the life and times of Thuli Madonsela, based on a really stunning portrait of Thuli that had been written by journalist Thandeka Qubule, who is here with me in the studio and who just smells so divine. I want to hold you closer. Thandeka, thank you so much for coming in.
Hi, Eusebius. Thanks for inviting me.
First and foremost, congratulations on this book. I know the process can be very long, the gestation period, the worrying and everything else, and I hope that you get many, many sales out of it.
Thank you.
I want to start by talking first and foremost about Thuli. For many people in the public space, they think that Thuli sort of like popped into existence as a thorn in the side of Jacob Zuma one day. But she has a life and she has a biography. Born in Soweto in an interesting household, a dad that in many ways is a typical South African man wanting to dictate to his daughter what to become. Paint us a picture of the circumstances into which she was born.
Okay, let's go to Soweto, 1962. Rivonia trial is on, highly politicized environment. Parents very interested in both the happenings in the country and the social goings-on in Soweto. Soweto has been leading trends, and it's an emergent, cosmopolitan, urban South African black community, and it is born of pain, forced removals, and degradation. And into a typical four-roomed home, small, Thuli is born. And she doesn't have a bedroom. She sleeps with her other siblings on the floor, on the kitchen floor, seven of them. The other room, the bedroom, is rented out to a tenant. You know, Thuli's dad loved a hustle. Mm. There's nothing he didn't monetize. And her mom is the sort of like village or the township midwife and a regular busybody. Reconciling couples that are fighting, being a midwife to babies being born, and generally feeding the poorer than them, and caring for society in general.
Absolutely. And of course, the mom and the dad, there's a lovely description that you have of when they had met each other. And it's also interesting how much sociology there is in terms of domestic workers, their place in the life of suburban whites. And along the way, you make reference to the very important work of Jacqueline Kok,
yes,
maids and madams, domestic workers under apartheid. I didn't even realize how special Thursdays are as a day for domestic workers. I mean, you're right here, and I quote, "Thursdays were special in this balancing act. Domestic workers would dress to kill and go to town. They would congregate in groups to gossip, pray, or unburden themselves by mimicking and mimicking and mocking their employers as a way of dealing with the abuse and racial prejudice that was such a significant part of their existence. Thursdays was for socializing. They were also for posing for pictures, which is how Noma Sonto met Bafana."
Exactly. On the other side of his lens, he found his destiny. And you know, those pictures from the olden days, I'm sure all your families have got those pictures, normally black and white, very stylized. You would have to pose with your hand on your hip. And, you know, those pictures were treasured, and they are part of family visual history. In many township homes today, even in rural homes, you have those. I know in my home, we've got a few there in Gwanobuhle Township.
But it wasn't an easy early life for Thuli under those circumstances.
No.
Three siblings who all died, for example, and not a particularly overtly political household, kind of household where dad hopes that daughter will become, if not a nurse, a teacher.
There's a big drive there for upward mobility. And for, I mean, Thuli's mom was arrested for hawking, trying to sell stuff at a school. And the father was also known for selling little bits of things, you know. You know, skripoto, that stuff that typical township households yes. want.
And oh, it grates me just thinking about it.
Steel wool for the pots. Yeah, so they did a lot, juggling many balls in the air to just make a living in order for them to feed their family and to keep their family together, safe, warm, in Soweto, and educated.
Where does Swaziland come into her biography?
Oh, Swaziland comes from mainly Bafana's background. And Swaziland was fortuitous in the sense that it was considered to be, especially during the Sobhuza days in Iraq, last century. I mean, it was considered to be a free zone. So many people would go into exile in Swaziland, and education was more stable, and they had a higher quality of education and a better quality of life in those days compared to conflict-ridden and feisty Soweto and the urban townships of South Africa. South Africa was going through a tumultuous political transition at the time.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because it is so difficult, and Jacob Dlamini tried to depict this in Native Nostalgia, how we are still trying to be fully human and ordinary, even in the midst of fighting this behemoth apartheid structure. And sometimes our dads and moms want the best for us and have to make choices. And it's not that those choices are apolitical, but you ship your child off to Swaziland, hoping that they can be shielded from some of the hot mess of what is happening inside the main borders of the country.
And ironically, so that they can be stronger and better educated to make a difference and to change South Africa at the time.
On page 24, Tandeka writes this about that time. In Swaziland, Maronsela grew up somewhat protected, at a distance from the intense politics back home in Soweto. Even though she would often read about what was going on and hear about it from her politically active elder brother Musa. Otherwise, she loved her comic books and picture romances, which she would often hide from the judgmental eyes of her teachers by placing them inside her textbooks to relieve her boredom. Shy and awkward, she felt unloved and was teased by her peers. But when she gets back in the early 80s to Soweto, things change, don't they?
Yes, they do. She goes to teach at Naledi High, one of the critical schools to the 1976 revolt, but also after the cinders of the revolt, the fervor of the moment is still at Naledi High and in the schools in Soweto. So she's a young teacher. Some of her students are her age. She feels ambivalent about her role, but she also throws herself into civic politics and into the union movement. She gets recruited at Regina Mundi in those heady days of the burial of the doctor activist who worked at Barrow Gwynedd and was, a very privileged young man, but he chose the life of struggle. His name was Dr. Neil Agard. And against that backdrop, she's recruited by a guy called Teddy Mbisi into the struggle for a democratic South Africa.
Absolutely. And that is absolutely pivotal in life, because now she becomes involved in some of the civic structures around Soweto. And at this point, even when you have a patriarch in the family, it is extremely difficult from stopping a competitive, feisty, deceptively graceful and shy on the surface young woman from keeping their dream of studying for an LLB at Wits and becoming a lawyer.
And the lure of meaning that she found in those politics of the emerging 1980s. And she definitely, definitely wanted to make her mark, make a contribution to her country. And she felt that the law could be the way to go. And so she set her sights on going to Wits to acquire an LLB.
Along the way, later on in the book, by the way, I thought you were quite generous about Wits University in terms of painting a place where, although it's not a perfect institution, that there are very important touch points there, that the law often gets a bad rap right up there with journalism. We think, you know, maybe there are way too many lawyers in this world of otherwise good people. But it's also a place where many great lawyers previously have been. And even though you guys sometimes gave even the VC hell at the time, that Wits is also a very important part of Thuli's political coming into age.
Yes, you know, at Wits, and I'm a biased judge here, in the sense that I'm a Wits product, and I'm a product of Wits's own turbulence and Wits's special alchemy of turning radical politics into contribution and eminence. And what happens at Wits is almost indescribable, but what happened at Wits of the 1980s is equally indescribable. But let me attempt, Eusebius. At Wits, you fell in love with the idea of a different country. And I try and bring this through aesthetically and in music and in the poetry of the time, and I choose the paintings of William Kentridge, and I also choose the music of band that was part of us then, and that's Mango Groove. And Mango Groove has this song called "And You Will See a Different Nation Here in My Eyes," and that used to grip us with the most amazing fervor to really begin to draft, to imagine, to theorize, to think of public policy, and to think of law, constitution making, that would catapult us into the country of our dreams. And we were seized heart and soul by that.
I was so fortuitous reading about that passage of you recalling William Kentridge's work, describing it, as well as Claire Johnson, who's a philosophy undergraduate major at Wits, the band, and specifically Another Country, and how, of course, he was responsible for some of the artwork that you see in the music video as well. Because just a week or two ago, completely coincidentally, I was at an art exhibition where one of the big parts of the exhibition was precisely to capture that moment. And I have to say, I really had never given proper thought to just how much political significance was in that Mango Groove sound at the time. It's easy now, especially with the young ones, to be cynical about the yearning for a better South Africa. But that particular track was really the kind of optimism that everyone had at the time about what we may yet achieve.
Yes, and we were beginning to see the dying years of apartheid. But interestingly, I had a book launch in Cape Town at an exhibition that had a few Kentridges, and I discovered that I cannot afford what a person's work, who I once discovered that he was, you know, one of us. He was, you know, he grew up in our milieu around Wits. But also, in his work, there is this man, Mr. Moneybags, or somebody based on a family figure that he knew. And this family figure depicts the callousness of money, the banality of money, the laziness of money towards the struggles and the feelings and the deprivations and the needs of the poor. And he still grips me, Kentridge, as much as he did back then.
20 minutes after 10, we're in conversation with Thandeka Qubule about No Longer Whispering to Power, the story of Thuli Marensela. If you've read it, give us a call. Let us know what your favorite bits were. And if you want to say how's it to her, ask her a question. You can also do that on the other side of this first break.
Eusebius is on Twitter at Eusebius.
23 minutes after 10, we're talking about No Longer Whispering to Power, the story of Thuli Madonsela. Let's go to the lines. Have you got your headphones on for me, Thandeka?
Yes, I have.
And we've got on the line Advocate Thuli Madonsela. Hello, Advocate.
Hi, Eusebius. And good morning to Thandeka as well.
Oh, hi.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Well, thank you for hosting, Thandeka. Samira, firstly, I just want to say thank you for the privilege of being the subject of your book.
Thank you, Tuli, for the gift of example.
And I thought she had done a rather magnificent job, Advocate Tuli. It must be weird when someone writes a biographical sketch about you. Between you and me, what did you make of it?
It was weird, as you are saying, because we live our lives the best we can, and all we seek to do is to be of value to humanity and not to harm humanity. And I think when somebody writes a story about you, it's a bit awkward. However, when you reflect on it, it's the greatest tribute somebody could ever pay to you by just deciding that you're worth examining. And for that, I'm grateful to Thandeka. But also, I'm also grateful for the reason she has written the book, because it's partly keeping the memory of that era alive, the manner in which me and her laughed. I mean, the manner in which the two of us met at that Sun City place, that really is a lovely thing to do, to remind us of how we came here and how important it is to stay on track.
Absolutely. But also, I think what's beautiful about biography in our country, Advocate Maranzela, I'm sure you will agree, is that sometimes we forget that history impacts the present. And one of the things, which I will get to in a little while with Thandeka, when we stop talking about her in the third person here, is how wonderfully she teased out, for example, your experiences in Soweto, your experiences at places like the Center for Applied Legal Studies, your involvement in the drafting of the Constitution process, and some of your jurisprudential convictions going back to the 80s. And one can see clearly see how she teased out those embryonic experiences with how you approached your job as public protector.
Absolutely. Thandeka's writing is remarkable. It has a sense of being a historian, a sense of being a poet, and a deep generosity that runs deep in her writing. I was really, really awed by her take on everything.
Absolutely. Advocate, thank you so much for joining us. I much appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, but also just to say thank you, Thandeka, for donating the proceeds to students in need. That's really, truly generous, and it's something we all should be doing.
And to your foundation and to Jonathan Ball, I'm most indebted.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Advocate Maranzela. Keep on doing great things. At what point did you guys actually meet?
Are you asking Tuli or me?
No, you.
Oh, we met in prison. In that cauldron that was Wits, I got picked up at Jubilee Hall. And I don't know where Tuli got picked up. I think after work, while she was working at the unions. And we got picked up at different times. I got picked up with a colleague to whom the book is also dedicated, Susan Goma. She was my BFF at university. And we were taken to John Foster Square, and we met there a great journalist who was drunk as a lord and refusing to be arrested, and that's the great Zwelakhe Sisulu. And we were then taken to, after a month of solitary confinement, taken to John Foster's, from John Foster Square to Sun City Prison. There in the quad in Sun City, the guards would allow us to listen to, well, enjoy the sun and chat to each other. There was Tuli, and that's how we met.
You are very quick, partly because I suspect as a writer you understood that you don't want to gratuitously insert yourself into the story of your subject. So we literally get one paragraph where you talk about being picked up yourself and then spending a month in solitary confinement, and then you leave it there. And I think to myself, my goodness. But then later on, when you talk about Thuli's experience, you say that although it wasn't a very lengthy imprisonment for Thuli, that, and Thuli doesn't like the idea of tapping into so-called struggle credentials, as too many people are wont to do, that nevertheless being in prison was an important part of some of the traits that she would later experience was embedded while she was there, caring about the conditions, about justice, about all of the other things, studying, etc., etc. But what was your experience like? I mean, I cannot fathom what that must be like. I'm just scared being locked up in Hillbrow for the weekend if I'm wrongly arrested by the police. And a month in solitary confinement, that must for you yourself, Tandeka, have been one of the most defining experiences of your life.
I don't know whether some of my memories when I started writing the book were colored by nostalgia and the lapse of time. But in preparing the book, I was able to go back there through help from the other fellow inmates that we were with. And people would say, "You remember Thuli? Thuli did this and this and that." And I would say, "No, I don't remember that." I discovered that we as prisoners all remember prison differently. But what I do remember is solitary confinement is bad for you and it's good for you. It makes you really reassess yourself and talk to yourself and get a hold of yourself, or else you will not survive psychologically. So that opportunity to self-appropriate, which is a deeply philosophical thing to do, in the absence of your books. By the way, de Klerk was our former president, de Klerk. He was Minister of Education at the time, and he declined our application to have our school books there. And poor Professor Sher, bless his soul, he died recently. He tried so valiantly to get us our study materials and our books, and so did Judge Kathy Settrell, who was our lawyer during the time. So prison is that experience that is, it defines you not outwardly, but in terms of your soul's journey. It is it's not even a milestone. It is a cul-de-sac at which you then turn around and live more deliberately after that, or at least that's my experience.
24 minutes before 11, time flying here, man. I want Tandeka for 2 hours. We're talking about her book, No Longer Whispering to Power, The Story of Thuli Madonsela. And she writes on page 45 about being imprisoned. At John Foster Square, periods of heavy interrogation were interspersed with long days of isolation. Through a misty window high above the cell, one could see homes across the road. One day, the security police drove the WITS students and some others from John Foster Square to Diepkloof Prison, where Madonsela had been detained without trial in contravention of United Nations detention prescripts. At Diepkloof Prison, also known as Sun City, women prisoners were separated from men and political prisoners from criminals. The female political prisoners were held in a part of the prison known as Baba Sorg, Afrikaans for baby care. And then after that, Tandeka talks about the routines that regulated life at Diepkloof. And this gave me goosebumps because it reminded me of that stunning documentary, which in the unlikely event you had not seen it, you must see it, Revolution in Four-Part Harmony. Because the way in which song comes into our struggle against apartheid, quite apart from your example you've already given, Tandeka, is amazing. But also just women singing while in prison. And I want you to close your eyes, Tandeka. You know you can trust me. We're good friends now. And I want you to listen to this song. And this is a song that has significance for people like Thuli Madonsela, Tandeka Qubule, taking them back to what it was like being outside in the sun as political prisoners singing their songs. Okay, Tandeka, I need you to talk because I'm choking up. And I can't have my team seeing me crying because I'm supposed to be the butch one in the group here. That song gets me every time.
Thank you very much, Eusebius, from all of us. Angie Mutecha, who were out there in the quad, Susie Nkomo, the prisoners who were in Pretoria, Barbara Hogan, Claire Wright, all of us, thank you very much. You really touched my heart. You're a beautiful soul. Thank you.
And that's the thing. We don't, and I mean, it's just we don't pay enough attention to where people come from when we deal with the folly of their imperfections in the present, because my Angie also appears in the book along the way, and yeah. That took me back to her own story, where when one of her parents died, she was still in prison. She wasn't even allowed to go to the graveside, just as far as the church, and then back to prison.
Yeah. Everybody came to prison. Deborah's child didn't make it. Yeah, they were lovely women, those cells.
And how important was song? We always have a stereotype about black people singing, but there's a very serious sociological element to the life-affirming nature of being able to gather, even in the courtyard, during your time outside the prison while you're supposed to be exercising in communion.
Song was defiance, and song was self-affirmation, and song was mutual affirmation, and song was solidarity, song was love. And we really learned how to love each other in the quad.
You know, when I was trying to decide which song to play, I couldn't choose between them because I knew both would make us tear up. And I decided to go with Joy Paradise, which is Paradise Road, which is just incredible. But the other one, which would have been equally difficult, we're not going to play it, is, of course, Johnny Clegg, particularly how important Neil Eggert features in the life of Thuli Madonsela and her experiences. And that internationally renowned song is one that was also very important. Along the way, Tandeka writes, outside in the sun, the political prisoners sang their songs, including, now let me put you here some vernac, Bashleli Bonke,
Tilingoni,
Yini Mandela. The songs were a form of creative expression, she writes, the singing of them an act of defiance. Let's take a couple of calls. Hello, Jimmy.
Hi. Hi, Eusebius. And hello to the guest speaker, Tandeka. Mm. I nominate Thuli Madonsela and Tandeka as a pair to run this country as president and deputy president.
They are stunning, aren't they?
They are.
Absolutely. Go get the book, Jimmy. You'll enjoy every second of it.
Will do.
Thanks, my man. Mohale, good morning.
Eusebius, good morning, and how's Tandeka? My question is literally based on the current challenges that women face, especially, you know, now recently, that women have been captured, women have been sidelined, women are, although we've got legislation that is trying to protect and you know, empower women, taking into consideration Thuli's character, of that of a liberator on her own right. And then would we be right to associate Advocate Madonsela with her liberation credentials with the current patriarchal challenges, to say, can she be a face of women transformation, so to say, if I may ask, from her experience with Advocate Madonsela?
Okay, that's a good question. I'm going to take a break in a sec, and I'm going to come back to that, Mohale, because I want to read from the book, which is the second last thing I want to pick up. There's just so much in the book. I can't do it all in 1 hour. But I'm going to answer your question by telling you one of my favorite parts of the book where Tandeka does exactly what you are asking. But let's take another call quickly. Daphne. Hello, Daphne.
Hi, Eusebius, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks for calling.
Yes, you know, Eusebius, I want to thank Tandi Gobule so much. Tandi,
you
can be the Ogobule.
Siti Makwambe, Siti Ngubenuga, Siti Matiba, Sichu.
Oh, you are totally umasiba. I am so glad that you have risen and you have written this book about Thuli Madonsela. I haven't read it. I'm going to Excuses Box tomorrow to buy it. But I just wanted to tell you, Eusebius, that Eusebius Tandeka, are you the daughter of the great Umfundisi Gobule?
Yes, I am. The late Gobule.
Oh, Eusebius, I just want to tell you that I'm not surprised about Tandeka, because I lived during the struggle era of Steve Biko. I was there. We were diehard activists with Steve Biko and the Stanley Mowgli, Harry Nandukulu, the Terra Likotas. I lived in that era, and I worked for the South African Council of Churches.
Oh, my God, and I know
who
you are.
Mm. So, Tandi, I just wanted to say, you know, I thank you, and that you are the daughter of a very great man. I knew your dad at the SACC, also the Tukobole.
And God, this is Daphne, I know who you are now.
Yes, and why did I tell you serious that your dad was also such a great man? Your dad was an activist in the church, and I knew you, knew him, and we used to be, when I came to work for the FACC, we were great activists, and you know that the Quarter Street was a street of activism and demonstrations by students from the University of the Witwatersrand. I salute you, and I salute the
stunning. Thank you, Sister Stephanie. Thank you for that.
Thank you so much,
Sister.
Beautiful. 12 minutes before 11. Now, one of the arguments that you make, and it's less an argument than really meditating on some interesting historic developments in the 1980s, and then drawing the connections between that and ultimately the big heart of the second part of the book, which of course is the oversight role that Thuli Madonsela came to play in our democracy. But the earlier parts of the book, I thought, laid a beautiful foundation for making some of the most important remarks in the second part of the book. So I want to read from the book again so you can hear how beautifully she writes, and then I'm going to ask her to comment on this particular argument and observation that in fact she had made. Along the way, Tandeka tells us about the UDF and compares and contrasts the UDF with the ANC in the 80s, and in particular, looking at the attitude of exiles towards what will happen the morning after apartheid falls. So here are a couple of excerpts as she writes about the UDF, and I want you to listen closely. The UDF years saw a new style of resistance organized and structured differently from the mass protest movement under the ANC in the 50s and distinct from the ANC in exile in significant ways. In an apartheid state that depended on African docility and compliance, the UDF and its mass insurrection agenda mobilized towards ungovernability. She goes on and then says, among the exiles, however, the dominant notion seemed to be that once state power had been seized, those who had fought for freedom would be entitled to do with it as they wished. A little bit later, drawing on the work of Raymond Suttner, she then says this, and I quote again, Suttner has spent a considerable amount of time and intellectual endeavor analyzing the difference between the UDF, within which Madonsela was an active member and agitator, and the culture of the ANC, which she was later to confront and find to be pernicious to the poor, self-serving, and venal. Suttner writes, while the other exiles were fighting imaginary enemies in godforsaken jungles, citing Thokozani Mhlonga once again, Amaqabane were crossing swords, or rather exchanging stones for bullets, with the real enemy, the unforgivable apartheid government. And then right towards the end of the chapter, this is what she writes in a chapter entitled Into the Cauldron of Politics. And now these are Tandeka's words, which I think are quite chilling. Often, acrimonious and protected conflict is, in essence, a clash between different worldviews. It has become patently clear that the most cherished assumptions of the drafters of the South African Constitution, including Thuli Madonsela, differ radically from those of the leaders of South Africa's fourth democratically elected administration. The two camps have different standards of rightness and offer fundamentally different answers to serious ethical governance and moral questions. And then the last line. Cock your ears. In the end, one has to conclude that incompatible agendas are at loggerheads more than two decades into South Africa's democracy. Conflict looms. Violence and social unrest are brooding as South Africans take to the streets once again. I thought that was really, really stunning, because we often treat black people as homogenous. And what you have done, Tandeka, is to show that already in the middle of the 80s, you have these big men, rotund as you described some of them, waiting to take over state capture with very weird tribal notions of what it means to be in charge. And you contrast that with a UDF. And ultimately, you say Zuma's biggest mistake was appointing Tulima Ransela, thinking he's appointing a comrade who shares his view of post-colonial state power. Little did he know.
Yeah, I put out there a number of theoretical lenses through which you can assess the current South Africa. I offer my preferred position, which you've described there, and the reader is free to choose which lens they pick up or which microscope they pick up to analyze current day South Africa. I am not married to any of these perspectives because my own perspective is a work in progress. I'm reading furiously at the moment to try and get a more penetrating insight into what is going on and what is exactly afflicting us.
But it is very clear, though, as you write in later chapters, once we then get into the heart of the Nkandla mess, that nevertheless, we always thought we'd be the exception to the post-colonial mess.
Yes.
To find ourselves in a neo-colony.
Yes. I think what we're looking at is neo-colonial reality. And that is why, at the moment, I'm reading Achille Mbembe. I'm reading Mahmoud Mamdani. I'm reading Tandika Mkandawiri to get to grips with different insights and takes on the post-colony. And I think it's I think it's beyond argument now that we are looking at a pernicious post-colonial reality, and
absolutely,
that we need to find ways out of this. I still think we are special.
Now, it is an optimistic book in many ways. And even, in fact, you quote Thuli in one of the pages. I can't remember exactly which page, where Thuli said, you know what, being taken to court by my democratically elected government is a beautiful thing. It means they at least still vaguely respect the rule of law.
Exactly.
And also, I must tell you that Deka writes with a wonderful turn of phrase, as Pumla Kola rightly said last night on social media, because she's also working through the book. Sometimes you have to put it down and allow yourself to take it in, because there's a sort of gentle cheek in some of the turns of phrases that could go over you if you read too quickly. I'm just going to share one with you as we end. She says, poor Gwede. This is what you have to say about Gwede now. I don't know if you recall the sentence.
Forgives me.
She writes, the politics of the belly were, by the admission of the ANC's own rotund Secretary General. Absolutely loved it. 1 minute left, Tandeka. You lay out here an important life of Tulima Ransela, an important office. You give it his historical roots. The current country is not the one that we imagined as another country. Where to from here?
That country that we imagined is still under construction. We all have the obligation to where we are, wherever this country finds us and wherever we are, to chisel a future that is more equitable and more just and resolve the problems of structural inequality, unemployment, poverty, and injustice.
Congratulations on a brilliant book. All the proceeds will go to needy students. Please go and buy this book. You are an excellent journalist, fantastic South African. And as Kravani Pillay also said to me, you are one of the heroes who kept so many of them grounded as part of the SABC 8. But your work and your history goes way before then. Well done. Congratulations. Happy
Kisses
sales.
And love to all of you and to my SABC 8 colleagues.